Congratulations! You have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Lambcast. This is episode 725, and I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, from Kirkham A Movie A Day. This week on the Lambcast, we have the movie of the month, a stylish thriller from 2016, The Neon Demon. The film won the Movie of the Month poll over three other selections, and we've drawn a crowd of lambs anxious, or at least willing, to talk about the movie. First up, joining us, establishing himself as a regular member of the Movie of the Month panel, Matthew Simpson from the Awesome Friday podcast. Welcome in, Matthew.
Good morning. Thanks for having me again.
Next, I'm not sure he knew what he was getting into when he volunteered for the Movie of the Month before the movie had been selected, but he dutifully followed through, regardless of what the choice was, from blogging by CinemaLite, my old friend James Wilson.
Hello.
Glad to have you with us, James. And
Thank you.
We have the champion of this month's film. I read his original review, and I'm not sure he knows exactly why he picked this movie and wants to talk about it. But we're going to make him lead the discussion anyway, because, damn it, this was his choice. From Cinema Recall, The Vern.
I have one question to ask you. Are you food or are you sex?
I'm not answering that question, because this morning I'm not sure which I am. Well, this 19—I keep wanting to put it in a different century.
It feels like it would be a different century, yes.
This 2016 film from... Nicholas Winding Refn. Well, how to describe it? Let me quote our guest host's own comment on it. I have a f***ing idea where to even begin.
Yes.
So, Vern, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you lead the discussion. And then afterwards, we do have an exit question that we're going to talk about. And first, Vern, take it away.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for joining me for this discussion of Nicholas Winded Refn's The Neon Demon, starring Elle Fanning and Carl Guzman, Jenna Malone, Abby Lee, Bella Heathcoth, featured appearances from Christina Hendricks and Keanu Reeves. This 2016 movie chronicles the journeys and adventures of a young girl who goes to Los Angeles to become a model, and then she befriends a makeup artist played by Jenna Malone and a few other models, and everyone there is enamored with her, and she's like very shy and, you know, timid and unsure of herself. And then other things happen and some strangeness occurs. I'm trying to keep this part very spoiler free, but before we do get into our discussion about The Neon Demon, I just wanted to ask everyone's kind of opinion about Nicholas Winding Refn and the first movies they saw of his. I'll start with you, Matthew. I mean, what was the first movie you saw of Nicholas Winding Refn's, and what do you think of his style?
I'm pretty sure the first one of his that I ever saw was one of the Pusher films, but the first one I really latched onto was Drive. And I think that he has a very singular style that either 100% works or the opposite of that. You can never say his movies are boring or uninteresting, but I don't know. The dude makes vibes movies, and I don't. I either vibe with them really hard or I don't vibe with them at all. And I'll let you guess which one of those this one is.
That is a great, great thing about the vibe movies. Totally like that, you know. Richard, how about you?
Well, I think the vibe idea is a good one, because I've only seen two of his movies, this one and Drive. And Drive I vibed with quite well. I like it. Felt to me very much like a 70s movie. It's a slow burn for the first two-thirds, three-quarters of the movie, and then it kind of launches itself. And I don't mind that style at all. I enjoyed it. I think it's deliberately paced. Whether or not that works on this particular film is another question. I'm gonna hold back on it like Matthew and suggest that maybe there's a different vibe going on here. This was my first time seeing the Neon Demon, by the way, so it was something that I went when I saw it playing and when it came out and I saw what people were saying about it, I thought, yeah, I'm not quite in sync with what's going on here, so I think I'll wait. And your championing it kind of pushed me over the edge. Okay, I finally need to see it, and well, we'll talk about how it all goes, but those are the only two films I've seen from this director.
All right. I'll get to my thoughts, too. Then I'm blinking on our other names. James, that?
The first movie I saw of his was Drive, but it turns out I have seen something that he directed earlier. He had directed a couple of early Miss Marple TV shows for British TV. The less said, the better.
All right. I think I had said everyone there, but missed someone. Apologize. The first movie I ever saw of his was Bronson, starring Tom Hardy, and that really got me interested in that filmmaker, mainly because of his use of songs. Then I saw the Drive movie and was really into that. Then he made a movie after that called Only God Forgives, also starring Ryan Gosling. And if you see Only God Forgives and the Neon Demon, they have a lot of similar styles to it. They almost seem like to be sister movies in a way of each other, just the way he uses the colors and the music, everything too. I saw this movie in theaters, and I was absolutely kind of in love with this movie from the first frame. It almost feels like a modern giallo. It is like a techno version of All About Eve. It's just has like these wonderful – it's what are we doing with this one here? I do know that this project started because Nicholas Winding Refn has two teenage daughters – who were going through puberty, and he notices that this society is a very sexualized society, and he wanted to make a movie that chronicles the girls growing up in the society because he was worried about his teenage daughters going into the stuff here. And this movie has elements of like Argento and Kubrick and Lynch in there as well. I just find it to be, it's one of those movies that, yes, it's style over substance, but the style is absolutely just gorgeous, and I love that it is. And being the fact that it is about the fashion industry and model, which is very, like, superficial and always a style over substance category, I thought it just worked perfectly for this movie here. Just kind of get into people's thoughts just generally about the movie. I mean, from the opening frame, which kind of does sort of like foreshadows what happens in the end of the movie there. I just want to just take people's like general opinions about what they're watching. If I could like be in your homes with you watching this movie and watch your reactions to certain scenes, I would just be loving that. Richard, I'll start with you. What's your kind of general?
Well, thank you for starting with me, because as you were talking about it, I thought immediately of what my impression of it was. There's a... like you said, it is a very good-looking movie. The imagery is startling. It's the compositions of some of these sequences, especially the ones that are supposed to be modeling scenarios, I think are elegant and elaborate. It looks like a beautifully made 90-minute perfume commercial, and it really is. It stands out in a lot of ways. I love the dark elements with the neon colors that appear sometimes. I like the interesting contrasting images that get shown at times. But there's a quote in the movie at one point that I completely disagree with, and that's probably the way I fit into the way of looking at this movie. One of the photographers, one of the designers who chooses our lead actress as his runway model, has a conversation with her at one point, and he says, "Beauty is everything." And if you believe that beauty is everything, you're going to love this movie. I don't believe that. I think that beauty is great. It's important, and I don't want to discount it, but it's not everything. And as a consequence, I'm not really a big fan of this film. It's not that I was disappointed in it, but it's just not something that, like we talked about, vibes with me. I think there are it takes a long time getting to where it's going. There's a weird vibe, like we talked about, throughout the whole movie with the characters, even before things turn as dark as they do. I did get the sense, ultimately, that it was going to turn into kind of a horror picture, but it seemed like it was late in making the turn that it does, and that irritated me a little bit. And I just, you know, we got to be careful about the spoiler thing. Let me just say that the fact that a person consuming an eyeball that has been vomited out by another person is not the most disgusting thing in the movie tells you that there are things about this that are a little bit problematic for a lot of people. And it was problematic for me. There's a sequence in here that I literally looked away from the screen and felt so uncomfortable about it, and it put me off of the film more than anything else. And you guys know what it is, so we'll just talk about that when we get there.
We'll get to that later, yes. Yeah. I understand completely. Gorgeous sequence right there. It's funny that you mentioned about like the colors and everything being shot well, because Nicholas Winding Refn himself is colorblind, so he's not able to.
Yeah, I thought colors. That was an interesting little note.
Also, and I wish we could have like a woman on this panel to discuss this movie, because yeah. This movie, even though he came up with even though Nicholas Winding Refn came up with a story for this, he did hire two women playwrights, to write the dialogue for the women in this, and he hired a female cinematographer to shoot it, and it does feature a mostly all female cast. And like I said before, he's a father of two teenage daughters. And he wanted to create a story just that he wanted to find the 16-year-old in him to write the story about. And I found that to be kind of fascinating as a guy who was a father. And also kind of fascinating, too, the fact that Elle Fanning went from 16 to 18 when making this movie. So she was kind of going through her own, premature. She's, she's growing up pubescent style right there. I'll go to you, Matthew. I'm going all the places here, folks. I apologize. Let's talk to you about what did you think about the general like style and the general thoughts about the movie when you're watching it. This is for yes.
So I did see this originally when it came out in 2016, and I rewatched it yesterday, and the best way to describe this movie would be that. I can't tell if it's beautiful but also repulsive, or repulsive but also beautiful.
I love that.
Because it's definitely all of those things all at once. And I don't really vibe with it, but it's like a train wreck. I can't look away from it either because it's so strikingly and beautifully shot. I think that the sort of satire it's going for is too on the nose to work as satire, and too over the top to work as satire. Like it misses the balance. But again, it's so visually striking, it's hard to look away from. I was just looking over the notes I was taking while I was watching it yesterday, and they include such things as, like, he put his initials in the title card, lol. Natasha Breyer should be working more. This is either entirely too on the nose or too far removed from actual human behavior to be relatable. even the end credits are gorgeous. Like, why is there a Triforce? There's just so much going on in this movie visually that, like, I can't quite put it together, but I find the actual content of the film pretty repulsive.
Okay. Fair enough there. And then, James, I hope I have this right there. What's your thoughts about the movie?
I despised this movie with the searing heat of a thousand suns. where to even begin? It is rather lovingly shot. And I remember that in your thank you for sending your review of it when you had first seen it. I read it, and you said the two important things that were going through my head when I was watching it. One was style over substance, which I thought this was very much a product of. And the other thing was, you said that there are shots in this that you would like to hang on your wall. Mm-hmm. And my immediate response to that was, if that's what you have to say about a movie, then it should be a photograph rather than a movie, because things are supposed to happen in movies. The shots aren't there just to be shots. They're supposed to be relatable to each other, and they're supposed to actually have action that goes along with it. The other thing was the deliberate pace was maddening. The movie unfurls at the speed of pretension, where everything is so deliberate that you just become inured to the fact that nobody's really saying anything.
Nice demonstration.
I think that's substance.
I think it's kind of like the
point of the movie too, because these are all models and actors. They want to appear like the better versions of themselves. Like, it almost feels like this is not our world. This is a completely different universe, almost like aliens trying to become human in a way. And I find that just to be absolutely fascinating. This has a lot of the same type of like line delivery as you would see in some Lynch movies. I mean, I'm watching Twin Peaks right now, and the way that characters interact with each other feels just very much like a soap opera. And I can kind of say the same thing about the acting in this. It feels like very overdramatic sometimes and very stilted. Like, everyone in this movie is sort of afraid to kind of show emotion in a way. The only character that does kind of show any like emotions is probably Keanu Reeves as the weird, creepy, almost like pedophile manager of the hotel room there. So yeah, I totally agree with everyone saying that this is a vibe movie. And I don't know, Richard, are you a fan of like Dazed and Confused? Because that's a vibe movie.
Yeah, Dazed and Confused I can relate to, because I lived through that era. I mean, that's basically, you know, that could have been me at any of those points. I wasn't, using pot and playing football, but everything else that was going on in that movie was something that I could relate to. It's hard to relate to anything in this movie because it is so stylized, and it's about a world that we don't really... most of us are only vaguely familiar with, especially, you know, mostly we kind of see that stuff in TV shows and movies, because we're not exposed to the real life thing. I mean, it's either this guy, the photographer, and I don't remember the character's name, the one who smears the gold all over Jamie.
Jack.
Or, Austin Powers taking pictures. You know, those are the kinds of extreme versions of what we see of the fashion photography industry, and it just really seems like it's so
and
separate from everyday life, which is why I think the soap opera comparison is a little problematic. Look, one of the reasons soap operas can be so deliberate, it was because they were doing an hour every day, 5 days a week, and the show goes on for years and years and years. This is a two-hour movie, and making it feel like it's going to go on for years and years and years, I think, is a little counterproductive.
And, you know, it's important to note too, Richard, now, not all of us are models. Well, maybe Matthew is, but we're not all models right here. And we're also not women.
Right.
And so the experiences that the women go through with this is not something that we would ever go through at all. It's also kind of a story about maybe like the loss of innocence, because when Jesse, Elefanten's character, comes in, she's very like naive and, you know, doesn't really know a lot of things. Although she says she does, but I think secretly she kind of does. And then as the movie progresses, she becomes a little bit more confident to the point where she does become narcissist. I mean, this movie, even the director says that this is about narcissism. I mean, he had a conversation with Elefanten before they shot this, and he says to her, "Do you think you're beautiful?" And she says, "Yes, I do." And he's like, "Yes, we're going to make a movie all about this, where narcissism is going to be the key thing here." And yeah, it's, I don't know why I vibe with this, because I saw it in a theater, and I don't know, I like watching people get uncomfortable during movies. I went to see Blue is the Warmest Color with a bunch of like senior citizens, and watching that movie with them was great, and I had the same reaction. Like that one sequence where you turn away from the camera, a lot of people got up and left the theater. So yeah, I totally get why people don't like this movie. I'm just a big fan of the style of it, and if I think this movie probably would work better in an art museum, this is not going to be for everyone's taste. But I do agree that if you're a fan of like Suspiria, the original Argento Suspiria, maybe even like The Red Shoes or Umbrellas of Cherbourg, movies that have like a lot of like vibrant colors in there, I think you'll just really enjoy this. I get elements of like Kubrick and Godard in this movie as well. What do you think about, I'll ask you, Matthew, because I said this was like sort of like a techno All About Eve. Do you agree with that?
I think a better comparison might be Mean Girls.
Okay. I think you're gonna say Showgirls, but
there's an clique, and they're sort of roasting this new girl, and yeah, I think that's a better comparison. And it's like, you know, neon drenched, blood soaked version of Mean Girls. But again, I would argue with less substance than Mean Girls, and trying to say something totally different than that movie ever did. I don't know. I'm having a hard time. I was looking forward to this episode because I was looking forward to talking through how I felt about it. But like, the more I talk about it, the more conflicted I get about it. So,
well, this is exactly the kind of show that the Vern was looking for. Yes. One where we're all uncomfortable and conflicted feeling awkward about although James has no problem expressing himself on this one. I like that.
I do actually agree. I do kind of wish there was a woman here with us, because like, I have just so many questions that I feel like I can't, and we probably can't answer. So
exactly.
But like, yeah, it's definitely like, I'm just going to stick to my thesis. It's a vibes movie, and you're either going to vibe with it or not. And I don't.
That's fair. Because you saw this in theaters too, right? Is that right, Matthew?
Yep, back when it was new.
Okay. Did I saw this at like a pretty popular AMC theaters, and it was an opening weekend that I saw it, and there's a good group of people there. Did you get the vibe of people watching it, the movie? Like, did you watch people when you watch movies? Like, did you?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I usually sit a little bit further back because I'm pretty tall, and so I get a pretty good view of the people in front of me. And yeah, there's definitely, you can sort of tell. The main theater I go to is stadium seating, so it's quite like a steep incline, so it's hard to see like people's faces. But you can sort of tell when people are, much like I was both time I watched this, deeply uncomfortable. But also like completely like captured by the movie. Like, it's a very weird dichotomy in that it's like people were very clearly not necessarily enjoying what they were watching, but unable to look away in the moment. Except for, I do remember at least one person just got up and left at a certain point the first time I watched it.
That's probably Richard. No.
If I had been in a theater, I might have stepped out for a few minutes. I probably would have come back in after a while, because I hate the idea of walking out on a movie, but there's always a first time.
That's fair. Guys, there was a thought in my head, and I just kind of like lost it while you were talking about the movie, just watching in theaters. So this movie came So I know Drive was in theaters, and a lot of people saw Drive. Drive got a lot of like critical praise, and I think some audiences love that movie too. The next movie he made, Only God Forgives, wasn't released wide in theaters, so not many people saw that movie. And so he goes from Drive to The Neon Demon, and that's a big shift. Because if you watch Drive, you're thinking, oh, wow, I like Drive very much. Got to be a lot of action in this. It does go slow, but there are some good action moments in this. And then you go from that to The Neon Demon. It's a complete different shift. I mean, they're both from the same director, and you can tell they're both from the same director. But being the fact that no one, not a lot of people got to see Only God Forgives, and if you saw that, you can start to see the style elements in The Neon Demon as well. So I want to know if people didn't see Only God Forgives, that may hinder their enjoyment of The Neon Demon. Because I was not a fan of Only God Forgives, but Only God Forgives is really highly stylized, like even more so than this. But I think the stylization works because he's doing a message about the fashion industry and about the style surface. I mean, there's that moment too where Elle's talking to Carl Grossman's character, and she says, "I've got no real talent. I can't write. I can't act. I can't sing. But I am pretty, and I can make money at being pretty." And if you look at it now with the, you know, the popularity of like TikTok and Instagram and everything like that, models making OnlyFans pages, and yeah, you can make money very much at being pretty. You don't so really
as
need
long
to have
as you do it
talent.
By the time you're 21.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
I would say that, like, I sort of get what you're trying to go with this, the comparison with Only God Forgives, but I might actually argue that if, and I think this is true of most people, if your introduction to Reppin was Drive, then I think maybe most of the rest of his films are going to be feel a bit weird to you, because Drive is by far his most straightforward film.
Yes.
Like if you watch even just his English language output, like Bronson and Only God Forgives and this and Valhalla Rising are all super highly stylized, really weirdly experimental, big, like either super big or super subdued, but really intense performances, and all very much vibes movies. And whereas Drive can be pretty much sat through like a fairly, like elevated, but still a fairly straightforward action movie. And I feel like probably speaking, a lot of people were off put by, if they started with Drive, they're going to be put off by almost anything else they watch, because at least in English.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, yeah.
I do want to talk a little bit about... Oh, go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, I did see Only God Forgives in cinemas, and I do distinctly remember being like, oh. Like, I had seen Bronson before I saw Drive, so I was a little more prepared than my friend who hadn't. But, like,
sure.
Yeah, I was definitely able to see in real time to, like, oh, that, like, that was, Drive was the outlier, not the standard, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. I do want to know, and I'm going to talk to you, James, because I thank you so much for watching something that you didn't quite enjoy and being on here to discuss your feelings about it. I want to ask you a little bit about the actors in this and kind of get your thoughts about them as general. But I want to talk to you a little bit about like Ella Fanning's character and Keanu Reeves. Did you have any character in this or any actor you liked in this? You don't have to like the character, but did you like anyone's acting in this?
Not particularly. Jenna Malone probably had the most to do as far as, you know, having a thought in their head besides themselves. Keanu Reeves came in and that was a surprise, but oh, this is one of those bad Keanu Reeves performances where he should just stand there, look pretty, and not talk. And the Bella Heathcote and I can't remember the name of the other
Abby
actress's
Lee.
Name.
Abby Lee.
They were just you know, they were doing their a basic you know, Dracula's succubus performance.
In a way, those were supposed to be the three sort of like sisters in Macbeth, who sort of like I guess tell our lead character what's going to happen to them, especially in that sequence where they're at the nightclub and they say to her, "Are you food or are you sex?" And even when the character says the names of lipstick and one of them mentions red rum, which is a shout out to the Shining. So in the beginning scenes, even the beginning opening shot, you know, it does sort of like a preview of what's going to happen down the line with them. There's even a sequence in the middle of the movie where they're not quite sure about, you know, what to eat before they mention Jesse's name, and we'll get into that little spoiler later on there.
I think you're giving that movie too much credit here.
I do that a lot of times, okay? So, yes. I think, I don't know if we have any more to say about our general thoughts of this. I feel like I'm the only one in this movie, this whole group here, that loves this movie. Like, I get what you're saying about it's too highly stylized, it's beautiful shots, but I just can't get into the storyline of it. Completely understand that. I'm still kind of surprised because I submitted Neon Demon multiple times to win Movie of the Month, and I'm very kind of surprised that it won. I really thought the Drop Dead Fred was going to win, but, you know, that's another highly stylized movie that I do enjoy very much. Don't know. Okay, so Mitch. Oh, yeah. I like Keanu Reeves' character because he's playing something different that he has played before. I like when he plays the bad guy. He was the bad guy in the movie The Gift with Cate Blanchett. I love his being a complete jerk. And the fact that he is very creepy and, you know, he does, you know, I can get into this a little bit there. He does go into Jesse's room, puts a knife in her throat and says, wider. Fun fact, he was really nervous about shooting that scene. And Elle Fanning on the commentary said that was a fun time.
Yeah, I don't understand why that whole sequence exists. In fact, I'm not sure why Keanu Reeves is in the movie, except to suggest that, you know, it's not just the fashion model industry that is full of creeps, that they're everywhere, including at the local motel, you know, which I don't think would surprise anybody.
And that was sort of like a dream sequence, because doesn't she, like, kind of wake up from that?
Yeah.
But then she does, you know, see or hear someone trying to break into her room, and he can't get in, so he goes to Nestor's girl's house. And there was a scene earlier where he's talking to her boyfriend, Dean, and says, "Gotta check out room 214. I went to this young girl, 13 years old, real Lolita shit. Room 214, gotta be seen." And he does break into the room, and we don't see anything. We just hear him basically rape and murder this young girl. And
at least so that's what our assumption is. And but, you know, like most people who have no human emotions or reactions, Jesse basically just leaves and doesn't really follow through on anything that might be going on in the very next room. It's just, I got to run away. I got to get away from this, as opposed to earlier she had suggested calling the police, you know, when there was something in her room. And, you know, Hank, the motel manager, you know, doesn't want that happening at all. Why she doesn't have that instinct here is not clear to me at all. And like I said, the very existence of these characters in the motel seems just to be, you know, an attempt to tie the creepiness of the world into something that is more real that we can relate to. or that most of us can relate to. I mean, I've stayed in some creepy places, and I've encountered people that are just a little bit weird. But I've never, you know, stood in front of a bunch of people naked and had gold paint rubbed all over me. So, you know, that part would be a little bit harder for me to relate to. But that there's something creepy going on next door in the motel room, or that the people who are running the motel are a little sketchy, that is completely normal. By the way, I lived in that area, and I drove past that motel 100 times in my life. You know, it's on Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena.
But here's the thing, too, when she does have – so in the movie, there is a leopard that shows up in a room.
Well, it's that a mountain lion in her room. It's a leopard that's stuffed in the later sequence in the house that she goes into.
Okay, mountain lion, but that was before she made her metamorphosis into the neon demon, the model's kind of like monster, the narcissist version of Jesse. So when she does see that woman being attached, she just like, you know what, I just need to get out of this. I'm thinking only about myself.
Right.
Because
okay, I can see movie, that.
She's just thinking about just herself, and she just wants to protect her own image and her likeness and all that.
Monologue on the diving board is the perfect epitome of that narcissistic character arc that she goes through. You know, at the beginning, she's clearly a character that changes in the course of the film. I'm not sure anybody else changes. They're all the same at the end of the film that they were at the beginning of the film. She's the one who changes. She goes from somebody who has some moral qualms about telling the truth to somebody who is willing to, like you say, ignore a crime that's going on next door and just pay attention to herself and be so self-centered that she, you know, basically acknowledges how her beauty is unique, and that's the most important characteristic, and nobody else can have it. And it's just
the only character that you thought you have some sympathy for is Jenna Malone's character, and even to a certain point, Carl Gustman's character, who I've only seen in Gaspar Noé's Love before this, and even the commentary track. He was saying, Nicholas Winding Refn was saying that, and this is Carl Grossman, and he's appearing in clothes for the first time ever, because his last movie was Gaspar Noé's Love. But even his character, who you may think that, hey, you know, he's, you know, sweet guy, he's not trying to like sleep with, you know, Elle Fanning character, this is still an older man trying to hook up with a 16-year-old. You know? And even if he doesn't know that she's 16-year-old, when she says, how old are you? And she says 16. He should just be like, okay, I gotta walk away right now. Because even though everyone, even like Christina Hendricks' character says, just say you're 19, and people will believe what you tell them to believe is one thing. But when she actually says for sure, I'm 16, he should have just gotten out of there. And he still wants to kind of like stay in it. You know, even if his intentions seem to be, you know, morally doesn't want to like try like to have sex with her. It feels like in a way like how Elvis Presley and Priscilla was sort of like, you know, grooming Elle. And you know, one day when she comes 18, I can move in there, but I'll be her first boyfriend and whatnot. I just found that to be kind of fascinating. So I don't know, thoughts on that?
Well, I think that character is ultimately sympathetic. He starts off, it's kind of creepy because of the photography session that they're doing at the start of the film, and then he does seem to be a little bit of a stalker type, but ultimately, you know, he seems to respect her wishes not to get physical. He acknowledges that it would be inappropriate. He kind of treats it as a date. They're, you know, when they go out and they have a nice time and it's interesting and they had fun and it doesn't really involve sex or any overt romantic elements to it. Mm-hmm. I think you do begin to empathize with him, and then that's of course when it's important that we do that, because later on when he gets basically dismissed by her in that restaurant, it's the indication, you know, that's the signpost that we've made a transition in her character.
Yeah, because she now doesn't care about anyone else but herself. She becomes Beauties and Everything, and there's that sequence where I don't know what you call the guy with the mustache. I forgot the actor's name.
He's a fashion designer.
Fashion designer, thank you. When he's talking to Dean, and he says, you know, look at Gigi here, Belle Heathcoth, and what do you think about her? And he's like, well, she's fine. And he's like, yeah, that's it. Because Belle Heathcoth's character had a whole bunch of, like, plastic surgery done. She had her ears pinned back, and she had lipo, and she had, like, a breast reduction and then another breast enhancement. So she had all this stuff done to her body. And then you got Jesse, who has not done anything to her body. She's just naturally beautiful. And you mentioned about that sequence when she's on the diving board and she says to Jenna Malone's character, you know, women will carve and cut and do everything. They will starve themselves just to look like how I do. The whole thing about beauty just not being, it's not the best thing. It's like the only thing. I do think that our culture does value beauty over a lot of things. And I think that was a message that Wyandon Refn was trying to say in this, is that especially for like young girls, because he was nervous as a father that I don't want my daughters just to be known only for just their beauty. And he was just making that cautionary horror tale about that, about what will happen if you become too narcissistic and how you praise yourself over what everyone else. And we kind of see that, especially what happens to Jesse later on in the movie. And I think we're at the part right now where we can close our general discussions. Am I right about that?
Oh, I think so, for sure, yeah. If we want to get into spoiler territory, this is perfectly fine.
Okay. So after Jesse becomes the quote-unquote neon demon, and she has that element at the hotel where she gets scared, she goes to live with Jenna Malone's character. And while there, Jenna Malone has kind of had her eyes on Elephant's character throughout the whole movie. Ruby is her name. Ruby had her eyes on Jesse throughout the whole movie. Even at the beginning sequence, the first line of dialogue she says to her is, "Am I staring?" Because she had her eyes. She was probably more glued onto her more than Dean was. So Jesse goes to live with Ruby, and this is after she got attacked, and Ruby's like brushing her hair, and she tries to make the move, tries to like seduce her and grind on her, and Jesse just like not having it all, pushes her off the bed, and Ruby just gets like very mad, and he's like, "You turned on me, that's it." She draws that giant circle with the X in there. That's supposed to be almost like a weird neon voodoo doll, whatnot. And then we get to the sequence, which was like Richard's favorite sequence.
Oh, Jesus.
The moments in the morgue. That's right. Our dear Ruby is not only a fashion makeup artist for live people, she's also a makeup artist for dead people. And she has this young woman, dead woman, in the room, and it's clear she got rejected by Jesse. James, let's go to you. Because we haven't heard from you in a while there, good sir.
Great.
I know you're looking forward to this.
Thank you.
Let's get into like your thoughts about this
necrophilia.
What's that?
His thoughts on necrophilia? Yeah, that's what we're looking for.
on the love of the dead, yes. Let's.
Well, of course, it's significant that this is her second sequence in the morgue where she's making somebody up. Mm-hmm. The first woman isn't as attractive, but the second corpse is, and that's who she chooses to, you know, get herself off on. But the other major difference is that there was another person in the room in the earlier sequence. So she, you know, okay. even as I'm talking about it and trying to, you know, rationalize things in this movie, I realize how stupid I sound trying to rationalize this stuff. Anyway, she's, she masturbates over the corpse, and then I'm blanking on what happens.
We should mention too that it goes back and forth. She goes back and forth between Jesse on the bed or on the couch, you know, touching herself, and then you go to Ruby in the morgue, and it's clear that you're not quite sure whose fantasy it is. I think Ruby is fantasizing about Jesse while she is with the corpse. That's why she covers her face halfway through.
Yes.
Yeah, but yeah, I remember. That makes sense. I do remember in like theaters when that sequence happened, when she takes out the clothes, people were like, "Huh?" And then she starts kissing her, and then she has like spit in her mouth to like make her sweat. And I laughed out loud, and people turned at me, like I was the weird one. Which I'm like, okay, you were. Sure, fine.
You were.
Sorry.
You know, but I just.
And I've seen a movie from 96 called Kissed with Molly Parker, which is exactly about a necrophilia, but it's almost like if Disney made a movie about necrophilia, it would be Kissed. Because
by the way, that's on their schedule right now, isn't it?
With a Corpse Variety at Disney movie?
Right up there. But you looked at a movie like Necromantic, because that is very much a very disturbing film about necrophilia, and then you got Kissed, where it's like, oh, cause that one, Kissed was also written and directed by a woman, and yeah, it's very bizarre and strange, but it's got really great performances, and it kind of has you wrestle with the character because you like her, but you don't like what she does, and that be the next future movie of the month, so we'll look out for that. So yeah, Kissed, that's right.
June for our women directed movie of the month series.
Oh, nice. Damn, there you go.
Yes.
I already know what Richard thought about that. My sequence is that this is where you know for sure that she becomes like a witch. Yeah, the witchy like tentacles to her. And then she actually gets spawned out there. We have that monologue sequence where she's on the dive board talking to Ruby. And then afterwards, Jesse goes back into the house and she sees Abby Lee. Or I get those two confused sometimes, those two actors. I can't tell one from the other. But she sees one of the models and then she says, "Are we having a party here?" Then another, I think it was Abby Lee that punches her.
Yes.
And she goes, they go run off. They chase after her with knives. They chase her all the way to the pool area. And they're all standing there. And then Ruby shows up and very calmly just pushes her into the pool. She cracks her head open. So Jesse's dead. All right. She's dead. And
they stab her with their steely knives, but they still can't kill the beast.
Be careful. I have to go to trial.
Yeah, I may have to. I didn't take it from the original lyrics, you know.
We're referencing Hotel California for all those playing at home who aren't over 40.
But she dies. She goes to the pool. She's dead. And the next sequence is we see Ruby in a bathtub full of blood on her. The two other models are in the shower, washing off the blood. And I gotta say, for a small, like, 16, 17-year-old girl, she has a lot of blood, all right? That is, like, just a massive amount of blood to fill a bathtub. I'm not quite sure you can fill a bathtub with the body of a young girl. I'm not sure. But it's to represent that they have devoured her. And now these models are now getting, you know, jobs and everything too. Forgot to mention that. What did we? Does anyone want to talk about the bathtub sequence before I move on?
Not particularly.
Okay, fair enough. All right. So, but there's one thing I want to ask you about, because this thing is kind of confusing for me. So Ruby, after she has this done, you know, she's watering the pool, cleaning off all the blood. She's laying on the grave site, smoking and reading. And then there's a sequence where she's in this kind of like this bare room with an open window, and the moon is rising just when she lies down, spreads her legs, and water comes out. And I know that's supposed to represent childbirth. Was she given birth to a new being? What does that represent? I am not a woman. I have never been pregnant before. I don't know exactly what that means. I know there's some symbolism in this. There's like a lot of symbols in this. And I know if we had a woman on here, she'd be able to say, yes, that's the lunar cycle. That's where all women do this. And, you know, help me out here. Matthew.
Thank you for calling on Matthew.
I mean, hard pass.
Okay.
No, I mean, I don't know. My only two thoughts here, at least three thoughts. One is that the bathtub is full of water and blood, not just blood. And she expels blood from her genitals, not water. And I don't quite know how to process all. I think the end of the movie is a bit of a mess. So,
but you understand my thoughts too. There has to be some sort of, like, you know, symbolism with that, with the moon and like the animals. There's like a lunar cycle, and women's period happens monthly too. And I
mean, it's all there. I just don't know. I don't know exactly what Refn is trying to do with this scene. Like, I get a lot of it. I get the, like, you know,
and the fact
when
that
they devour
so...
her. Yeah, like when they devour her, it's all about, like, you know, there's the jealous one and the vain one. And then, like, you could argue that, like, Jenna Malone represents more of, like, the industry at large, and they literally consume her for her beauty. And I think it's, like I said, I think earlier, that, like, it's all a bit too on the nose to work as satire. Like, it doesn't strike the right balance to really work. And I feel like there's things he's going for that I can't really speak about with enough confidence to say out loud, but, like, I don't think any of it really works anyway at this point in the film. And I don't – I mean, it's certainly a striking visual, though. Again, it's a thing that I'm sure – you know, if this was a video podcast, I would make a face to show you, like, what my face looked like when I was watching this. Because, like, I feel like it was – again, just going back to that, like, kind of, like, beautiful but also kind of repulsive all at once, and mostly repulsive because, like, I just don't think what he's going for works, and I can't properly articulate what he's going for.
Hey, if you send me a picture of that face that you made, I will put it in the YouTube version of our podcast.
Nice. All right, if no one has anything else to say, we'll move on to the last sequence where our two models have now gone into doing a job at this pool. Jack is there shooting some sort of, like, I don't know, I guess commercial for Ray-Ban sunglasses. I'm not entirely sure what they're shooting. The other models that they did hire gets fired. And she even says to one of the models earlier, did you ever have a woman screw you out of a job? And one of them says yes. And she goes, well, what did you do? I ate her. Ooh, gross. And not knowing that she actually did eat her. She's thinking that she, you know, destroyed her career or some reason. All right. So we have our two models. They're standing side to side with each other. One of them, I believe, was the Belly Thoth. She's the one
that had the work done.
Yes. When we're done, she starts to get, like, really ill and not feeling so well, and she leaves the chute. She gets it. She throws up the eyeball, And I believe shows up, and Bella's like, I have to get her out of me. I have to. And she performs, I guess, coup de grace, or what's, you know, where she, the samurai thing.
Oh, Hari Kari.
Hari Kari, thank you very much. Where she.
With a pair of scissors.
Yeah.
Very impressive, I gotta say. All right. It's not easy to do with a pair of scissors. All right. Yeah, she disembowels herself, and Belly Heathgoth. No, sorry. Yeah. Belly Heathgoth. Or Abby Lee. Abby Lee.
Yes.
She's the eyeball
observing
that she throws up, and you see her face. She becomes very much, when she takes off those sunglasses and those eyes, and like, oh wow, you are completely plastic. Which, yes, you're totally right. This is a sort of a Mean Girls sort of ripoff in a way too. So I like that very much, because she takes off the sunglasses. She has like the stoic face in there. Takes the eyeball, eats it, yum yum yum, and then leaves to be in a perfume ad with music by Sia. The end. When I saw the end of that, I was like, oh, okay, yeah. Everyone is going to hate this movie, but for some reason, I love it. And I was wrestling my mind about it, too, when watching it, because a lot of things I don't think made sense for it. And then I realized this is a movie that I just gotta have it let it be. I think it's gorgeously looking. It doesn't have storyline to it. It's not a movie I can recommend really to everyone. It's a movie that I will show to friends to prove that you are still my friend after many years. I use it as a friendship test.
Nice.
If they don't cut you off after watching this, then they must really like you because
yes.
of what you've imposed and asked them to do.
And, yes. and depending on their reaction, you say, you can leave now.
I was going to give people a challenge here. Right? If you can make it to the end of this movie, I will help you out doing this. All right. I helped you move. Now you got to sit down and watch The Neon Demon.
Well, at this point, I feel I could be perfectly justified in asking you to pick me up at LAX.
Okay. I should probably do that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Yeah, I was just reacting to picking somebody up at LAX.
The seventh circle of hell.
Yes.
All right. Let's just get our grades and just general thoughts about the movie. Just about this, I'm gonna ask you, Matthew, name one thing you liked about the movie and one thing you didn't like about the movie. Fair?
One thing I liked about it, the stylish and striking cinematography. And one thing I didn't like about the movie, the content of the movie.
Okay. It's almost like saying, like, I like looking at the box art of the movie, but I don't like what's in the movie.
I mean, basically, like,
yeah.
I don't think you're wrong. You said something earlier about, like, you know, how a lot of the shots in the film, like, you could take a frame and put it on your wall.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, there's a lot of really striking visuals. I think it's gorgeously shot. I think Natasha Breyer should be working more than she is, because this film is absolutely gorgeous. And I think on a technical level, it's basically unimpeachable in that way. And I think that it is also utterly repulsive.
But see, I gotta have those visuals with that score from Cliff Martinez, because that score adds to the music of it. And I can't just have just a photograph. I need to have the actual.
I'm gonna jump in for just a second.
Martinez doesn't do any wrong. Like he's also, the score is also great.
The score felt to me like it was outtakes from Vangelis' Blade Runner score. You know, it was just leftover bits and pieces. It fit with the theme of the movie, but it really didn't feel all that original to me. And it just felt warmed over, I think. But that's me. That was not
should
thing.
Should have been nominated for an Oscar.
I mean, I wouldn't go that far. And I sort of get what you're saying, Richard, but I still think I think it fit the film really well.
Yes, it did.
But like I say, this is, again, like, in terms of, like, the filmmaking involved, I think this movie's great. And in terms of what the film is actually showing me and what it's trying to say, it's repulsive.
Okay.
So that's my review.
What would you give a score out of this, out of five?
Shrug emoji.
Okay. All right.
Like, I think I ended up giving it like 3 out of 5 on Letterboxd, and that is because I don't think it's entirely without merit, and I do think the technical stuff is worth at least seeing. But like, I don't know, man. Like, this is, I'm always on team see it for yourself, but this is definitely a see it for yourself movie. I have no idea who I would ever possibly recommend this film to, ever.
Oh, well, shoot, because I just gave it to my mom to watch for her birthday, so I don't know if she's going to take it now. Wow. All
right. That's,
hope she doesn't have a weak heart.
That is a capital C choice, salter. Sir.
James, let's get to your thoughts. Give me one good thing you liked about the movie and one thing you didn't like about the movie.
I like the occasional striking image, but as much as everybody says it was beautifully shot, there's an awful lot of murk in this movie. And, you know, every so often, it's just a black screen. So, you know, it depends on where you pick your frame. What I didn't like about the movie?
Yes. Hello?
The silences.
Oh. All right, bravo, bravo, bravo. That was great. All right. Score you would give it?
1, because people evidently got paid.
Oh, and they were paid too little. I agree. They should have been paid more for that, James. Appreciate those thoughts. Richard, give me one thing you liked about this and one thing you didn't like about this.
Well, I liked some of the composition issues. When the fashion designer is interviewing the women, and you know they're all there in their underwear, and it's a stark white background, I thought, this is an interesting approach, and I can see why he's looking for some kind of minor detail that stands out on all of these people, and it gave me a little bit of a sense of how that industry might work. I like the visual of creepy photographer Jack rubbing gold on Jesse when she's in the dark and the makeup on, and I thought that was composed in an interesting way as well. So there are sequences that look striking and interesting, even though they aren't about anything. So that's what I liked. What I didn't like was how repulsive the one sequence was that we've already talked about, and how it took me out of any interest that's going on there. So I and one of the reasons I kind of have gotten rid of the Lamb scores over the years is because I want people to listen to the discussion and not just go to a number. I would not be recommending this film to anybody that I know, except you, Vern.
Yes, okay, fair enough.
Because I know you like Showgirls, and you got us through Species. So
yes.
And Howard the Duck, and I'm going, okay, there are films out there that are deliberately annoying. Who would like that? And I'm going, the Vern.
Yeah. And I appreciate art, Richard. All right, I'm a fan of art.
It's okay.
And I want to make sure other people understand my love of these art films right there. All right, that's fair. As I said before, I do absolutely enjoy this film. One of my favorite sequences is the moment where they're at the party and that strobe light dance sequence happens. Like that very much. When she does turn to the neon demon, she's getting double of herself. I like that as well. I laughed out loud at the whole necrophilia scene because I thought it was absolutely ridiculous. And the fact that this is in a mainstream movie. Like, this was playing everywhere. It was made by Amazon Studios, and they released this movie wide, and studios were like, yes, necrophilia scene, people will love this. Let's put that in the movie. And yes, the fact that it was playing at wide theaters with, like, general audiences just made me just laugh and love, because people were trying to say, oh, I love Drive. Oh, Keanu Reeves in this movie. Oh, this is going to be great. It's about models, and it's going to be part horror film. And that sequence comes on. They're like, what the fuck? Oh, yeah. So,
and it succeeded in keeping people out of the theater seeing it.
Yes. The weirdness of it, the musical score, the the acting, the composition, the campiness of it, because this is a camp movie. It's a horror movie. It's a melodrama. It deals with existentialism. It just has all these elements into it. And yes, it is a movie you just kind of like vibe with. And I definitely vibe with this movie. I think it's a lot of fun. It's great. Yeah, that's all I really have to say about The Neon Demon. I know I've had other people that I've talked to on my Facebook group wall, and I was actually very kind of surprised they actually had some good things to say about The Neon Demon. So yeah.
Well, I'm sorry we couldn't get them on the show to join you.
I'll leave a quote for another year. I won't say the name right there. He says, "Love this movie. As for explaining it, remember the Refn rule. His movies aren't that complex from a story point of view. A lot of times he even touches on themes touched on earlier filmmakers. It's not what he's saying that's the draw. It's how he says it. That's the real treat." A lot of women are saying that this is one of my favorites of the year that I was friends here. I have a friend of mine. She says, "So cool. I know a lot of people hated this movie. I most certainly did not." And yeah, there's I'll find the link later on, but there's a woman critic that also gave it good reviews, but she also says she doesn't like a lot of it too. She likes some things of it and hates a lot of things. For me, movies are like albums, and I can like certain tracks of albums, but maybe not the whole thing. And from listening to everyone's discussion of this, it seems like they like certain things about this movie, but they do not like the overall movie of this. Am I fair in saying that?
No.
you talked about the cinematography being, you know, striking, and but you
like there are some.
I said there are some striking images in it, but I think, you know, those are the highlights. I found a lot of it murky, really murky, and to the point where, you know, he had to do a lot of fudging in order to get an R rating. But, when he had to use his contrast vision in order to get a good composition, then it looks very good.
Oh. Fair enough there. All right, we're going to close out the discussion on The Neon Demon. Thank you, everyone here, for watching it. Thank you to everyone out there who voted for this movie. You are sick, twisted individuals like myself, and I love you dearly for doing so. Yes, I had no idea that there were many people like me that went to see this movie when it did discussed. So thank you to everyone out there that did. So,
all right, we're going to take a quick... Go ahead.
I want the names of those six people. I want to block them from my Facebook page.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we're going to have our exit question of the week.
Cinema Recall is available everywhere you find great podcasts.
The hell was that?
It's our voice promo guy.
Follow them on Facebook and Instagram under Cinema Recall Podcast and on Twitter at @Cinema_Recall.
Vern, can we afford to have a voiceover guy?
We can't afford not to. He used to be a voice guy for movie trailers, but now he just follows me around and gives me movie trailer narration.
That's really sad.
What? Now we're giving him purpose in life. He now has a reason to go on.
Check out past episodes at cinemarecall.net. Promise it's fun!
Well, it's time for the exit question of the week. We're back here to discuss it with you. This is a film, The Neon Demon, that was about the fashion industry to some degree. It's certainly about models and jealousy and those kinds of things. The question that came to my mind was, what films about models or the fashion industry could you recommend to our listeners? What kinds of other films with similar subjects, obviously not the necrophilia, could you recommend to our listeners? So let's start with James. James, do you have some films featuring models or the fashion industry that you think people might be willing to listen to or watch?
Sure. Let's talk about Funny Face, directed by Stanley Donen, because it doesn't have a sequence where Fred Astaire dances on Audrey Hepburn's corpse.
That's a good choice, by the way. Yes, I'm glad that we don't have Audrey Hepburn lying on the table and Fred Astaire tap dancing on her nose. That would just not be cool.
Don't even go there.
And what is that, 1953, 54, something like that?
Something like that. Well, Hepburn,
I'm trying to remember. 50s. It might have been later.
Mid-50s.
Okay.
It was after a big splash.
Excellent. All right. Matthew, how about you? Have you got any films that you can recommend that have models or the fashion industry at their core?
Yeah, two. One, you could just watch Zoolander because it's a perfect movie about models. But also, there's a 1998, it's actually technically a TV movie produced by HBO called Gia, which is a biopic of Gia Carangi, starring Angelina Jolie. It was one of our earliest looks at Angelina Jolie as like a serious dramatic actress, one that got her a lot of press. And it's actually just it's a really well-acted, really well-shot and told story. And it's a little bit heartbreaking, fair warning, but it is it's a great movie, and I definitely recommend it to most people.
Nice. Vern, I'm sure that you've been thinking long and hard about this and have come up with something that will be exciting, interesting, and unusual.
I was not thinking about it, but I had one movie down, which is going to be In Fabric, which is about a dress that kills people. But instead, yes.
I now have to look for this movie.
it's from Peter Strickland. In Fabric, 2018. But the movie I'm going to talk about is Blood and Black Lace, directed by Mario Bava, and it is about a serial killer who's targeting models at a fashion show.
All right.
So yeah, that's my choice.
I like Bava.
Yeah. So it's a 64 Jello film, and yeah, that's really is about this killer, and he's targeting these women at a fashion show. So yes, and as kind of a connection with the Neon Demon, especially with the use of colors. The use of colors in Bava films are great, and this one, it's really good too. And it's got a great score as well, so I recommend both of them. I recommend more Blood and Black Lace. In Fabric, it's about the killer dress for like half of the movie, and then the other half it switches to something else, and I didn't like how it switches, but watch it, decide for yourself.
All right, and I've got two for you. One is straightforward kind of horror thriller that deals with issues that are kind of related to some of the visions that we have in this movie, and that's The Eyes of Laura Mars, where Faye Dunaway, as a fashion photographer, starts seeing visions of murders of models that she has been working with. And, there's kind of a supernatural element to what's going on, but it's also kind of commentary about the way she visualizes the fashion industry. Most of the images that she photographs are things that probably would have fit in with this movie. You know, there's a lot of death and dismemberment and horrible things going on. And like I said, it's kind of a horror movie, and it's a fictional one. One that is based on reality. It's very horrifying. And it does kind of fit into these themes here, and it unfortunately has a similar kind of outcome, and that's Star 80 from Bob Fosse, which was about the life and death of Dorothy Stratton, the Playboy centerfold who became a cultural icon and was murdered by her husband who had jealousy and envy and career. You know, he basically was trying to, you know, ride the vapors, so to speak, and do the same thing that the models in this film did, you know, suck off of her fame and become somebody as a result, and it just didn't work out. And he doesn't vomit up any eyeballs. Instead, he kills the source of his celebrity power, whatever interest he has. And the fact that it's based on a true story is tragic, but it is, of course, like I said, kind of a commentary on beauty and the world of envy.
I watched that one, and I think it's great that The Eyes of Laura Mars was directed by the guy who made The Empire Strikes Back by the guy who made Halloween.
There you go.
That's right.
I don't know those guys' names. I hope they do better stuff, too. But
John Carpenter. Yeah. John Carpenter and Irvin Kershner.
Kershner, yes. Yeah. A couple of people that we're not familiar with at all.
Yeah, a couple of no names right there. Yeah, I know.
And that young guy who plays the cop, he's kind of pretty good too.
Yeah, he would get better.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Richard.
Yes. At some point. All right, we're going to close it off here, and I want to give everybody a chance to tell us what they are doing, what they want us to see and look at. Share us with us something that you would like our audience to know about. And James, we're going to start with you. I know you don't really promote yourself very much, but you've got to have something that we could look at that'll draw us for a few minutes at least.
Yes, I've been releasing the Blogging by CinemaLite Index every week, and it should be completed by this Friday.
All right, well, that's pretty good.
Very cool.
You'll have a link on the index on the site, right up in the upper right corner.
Vern, you got something that you want us to turn our eyes and ears to?
Yes, well, I'm doing our Yahoo for Yargos series over at Cinema Recall, looking at the films of Yargos Lanthimos. We just released our episode on Poor Things with Ryan Luis Rodriguez of One Track Mind, so check that out. We have The Favorite coming out soon with Jim of Film Rage. I'm going to be an upcoming guest on the Collateral Cinema podcast talking about Lost Highway. David Lynch's 96 movie, which be
you put it on a double feature with this, it would be great.
You could, yeah.
Yes.
So look for that. And I know there's other things right now that I just can't think off the top of my head right now. Oh, I'm going to be on Howard Kasner's podcast very soon. His Pop podcast, Art. Pop Art, yes. And I totally forgot the movies that we're discussing with that. But... oh, yeah, I think, May, December, and another film he had me do, which I can't remember the name of it right now. But, yeah, check out Pop Art, because I will be on that podcast coming out shortly. And a few other ones, yeah, that's it right now. I'm sure I'll think of them. Follow me on social media, Cinema_Recall on Twitter and Instagram, and I'll post links to when those shows post along with this one here.
All right, and I always share links to everybody's sites, so we'll make sure that those things come up. Matthew, did you have something that you would like people to look at and listen to?
Yeah, you can always find me. We do I'm the host of the weekly podcast, the Awesome Friday podcast, where me and my podcasting co-host Simon review two new movies every month. You can find that anywhere you can find podcasts or at awesomefriday.ca. I also write freelance for a number of outlets, and you can find links to all my work, including this episode when it goes up, at stretched.ca, which is my personal portfolio. And then last but not least, late last year, late 2023, myself and other Lambcast semi-regular Thomas Stoneham Judge, another local critic here in Vancouver, co-founded together a new critics association called the Cascadia Film and Television Critics Association. And nice. We've managed to pull in, about two dozen members, all within the Cascadia region of North America. So that's very roughly speaking, British Columbia, Canada, and Washington and Oregon states in the U.S. With the intent of, you know, furthering some unheard voices and also highlighting that region of the continent in terms of filmmaking. And it's been very exciting so far, and I'm very, very happy and very proud to be a part of that. And you can find that at CascadiaCritics.com.
Very nice. On my site, as usual, I'm covering things. If I see it in a theater, you'll read about it on the site. I've also started a new project, Wallowing in Nostalgia. So if you haven't if you haven't realized it yet, I'm a child of the 70s, and I'm afraid I'm full of all of those sexploitation films that came out in that era. And so my new project is titled Grindhouse Alley. I've only got one post up on it right now, but look for plenty to be coming in the near future. I'm going to do every, you know, I tell you what, I got inspired by DVD I bought, a Blu-ray I bought, which is basically 6 hours of trailers for exploitation films from the 60s and 70s. And as I'm watching it, I say, I got to see that movie. I got to see that movie. I got to see that movie. And I say, I might as well just do another project. So that's what I'm going to do. So keep your eyes open.
Oh, Richard, you're speaking to my heart so much.
Good.
You have no idea how much I love this so much.
Good. Well, the first episode or the first entry I have is on Scream and Scream Again, which is a weird Vincent Price, Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee film where those three actors, I think, are in the movie a total of 10 minutes.
Yes. Got to be AIP.
I don't have enough weird movies in my life, and I need to find more things to subject friends to watch. So very much.
This one's plenty weird. So I'm going to do a written post, but I'm also going to do some podcast things and some YouTube reviews on it. So there'll be a lot of different kind of stuff on it, and I'll make sure to connect it to my home site so that people can find everything that I post there. All right. Once again, I want to thank the Vern for bringing this to us. I don't really want to thank him, but we're grateful that you suggested.
You're still my friend after I have you watch the movie. I don't know about James and Matthew. I hope they'll become friends of mine. I hope you were friends during this conversation, and I thank you very much for doing this, and hopefully we can all be still friends still.
Yes, of course can.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And I appreciate everybody coming on a little bit early for me this week. All right. Until next time, we'll talk to you soon, folks. Take care.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on X, formerly Twitter, at Lambcast. And you can find us on YouTube as well. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com. We'd also love it if you would leave a review on iTunes. Ha 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 ha